Good evening. This is 91.5 WMFO Medford. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of the station management, Tufts University Administration, or the Board of Trustees. My show runs this summer every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. Tonight on the program, for the next hour, I will showcase the YouTube channel After School, spelled After, S-K-O-O-L. The first 20-minute video is Mass Psychosis, How an Entire Population Becomes Mentally Ill. The second 25-minute video is called Chemical Farming and the Loss of Human Health by Dr. Zach Bush. We'll finish the hour with the great Ram Dass and his The Freedom of Being Nobody. Thanks for listening. I will be here this summer every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. And now, Mass Psychosis, How an Entire Population Becomes Mentally Ill from the After School YouTube channel.
The masses have never thirsted after truth. They turn aside from evidence that is not to their taste, preferring to deify error if error seduce them. Whoever can supply them with illusions is easily their master. Whoever attempts to destroy their illusions is always their victim. According to the psychologist Carl Jung, the greatest threat to civilization lies not with the forces of nature, nor with any physical disease, but with our inability to deal with the forces of our own psyche. We are our own worst enemies, or as the Latin proverb puts it, man is a wolf to man. In Civilization in Transition, Jung states that this proverb is a sad yet eternal truism, and our wolf-like tendencies come most prominently into play at those times of history when mental illness becomes the norm rather than the exception in a society, a situation which Jung termed a psychic epidemic. Indeed, it is becoming ever more obvious, he writes, that it is not famine, not earthquakes, not microbes, not cancer, but man himself, who is man's greatest danger to man, for the simple reason that there is no adequate protection against psychic epidemics, which are infinitely more devastating than the worst of natural catastrophes. In this video, we are going to explore the most dangerous of all psychic epidemics, the mass psychosis. A mass psychosis is an epidemic of madness, and it occurs when a large portion of a society loses touch with reality and descends into delusions. Such a phenomenon is not a thing of fiction. Two examples of mass psychoses are the American and European witch hunts of the 16th and 17th centuries, and the rise of totalitarianism in the 20th century. During the witch hunts, thousands of individuals, mostly women, were killed, not for any crimes they committed, but because they became the scapegoats of societies gone mad. In some Swiss villages, writes Francis Hill, there were scarcely any women left alive after the frenzy had finally burned itself out. When a mass psychosis occurs, the results are devastating. Jung studied this phenomenon and wrote that the individuals who make up the infected society become morally and spiritually inferior. They sink unconsciously to an inferior intellectual level. They become more unreasonable, irresponsible, emotional, erratic, and unreliable. And worst of all, crimes the individual alone could never stand are freely committed by the group smitten by madness. What makes matters worse is that those suffering from a mass psychosis are unaware of what is occurring. For just as an individual gone mad cannot step out of his mind to observe the errors in his ways, so too there is no Archimedean point from which those living through a mass psychosis can observe their collective madness. But what causes a mass psychosis? To answer this question, we must first explore what drives an individual mad. While there are many potential triggers of madness, such as an excessive use of drugs or alcohol, brain injuries, and other illnesses, these physical causes will not concern us here. Our concern is with psychological, or what are called psychogenic triggers, as these are the most common culprits of the mass psychosis. The most prevalent psychogenic cause of a psychosis is a flood of negative emotions, such as fear or anxiety, that drives an individual into a state of panic. When in a state of panic, an individual will naturally seek relief, as it is too mentally and physically draining to subsist in this hyper-emotional state. While escaping from the state of panic can be accomplished through adaptive means, such as facing up to and defeating the fear-generating threat, Another way to escape is to undergo a psychotic break. A psychotic break is not a descent into a state of greater disorder, as many believe, but a reordering of one's experiential world, which blends fact and fiction, or delusions and reality, in a way that helps end the feelings of panic. Silvano Arrieti, one of the 20th century's foremost authorities on schizophrenia, explains the psychogenic steps that lead to madness. Firstly, there is the phase of panic, when the patient starts to perceive things in a different way, is frightened on account of it, appears confused, and does not know how to explain the strange things that are happening. The next step is what Arrieti calls a phase of psychotic insight, whereby an individual succeeds in putting things together by devising a pathological way of seeing reality which allows him to explain his abnormal experiences. The phenomenon is called insight because the patient finally sees meaning and relations in his experiences. But the insight is psychotic because it is based on delusions, not on adaptive and life-promoting ways of relating to whatever threats precipitated the panic. The delusions, in other words, allow the panic-stricken individual to escape from the flood of negative emotions, but at the cost of losing touch with reality, and for this reason, Arrieti says that a psychotic break can be viewed as an abnormal way of dealing with an extreme state of anxiety. If a panic-triggering flood of negative emotions in a weak and vulnerable individual can trigger a psychotic break, then a mass psychosis can result when a population of weak and vulnerable individuals is driven into a state of panic by threats real, imagined, or fabricated. But as delusions can take many forms, and as madness can manifest in countless ways, the specific manner in which a mass psychosis unfolds will differ based on the historical and cultural context of the infected society. But in the modern era, it is the mass psychosis of totalitarianism that appears to be the greatest threat. Totalitarianism, writes Arthur Verslewis, is the modern phenomenon of total centralized state power, coupled with the obliteration of individual human rights. In the totalized state, there are those in power, and there are the objectified masses, the victims. In a totalitarian society, the population is divided into two groups, the rulers and the ruled, and both groups undergo a pathological transformation. The rulers are elevated to an almost godlike status, which is diametrically opposed to our nature as imperfect beings who are easily corrupted by power. The masses, on the other hand, are transformed into the dependent subjects of these pathological rulers and take on a psychologically regressed and childlike status. Hannah Arendt, one of the 20th century's preeminent scholars of this form of rule, called totalitarianism an attempted transformation of human nature itself. But this attempted transformation only turns sound minds into sick minds, for as the Dutch medical doctor who studied the mental effects of living under totalitarianism wrote, "There is in fact much that is comparable between the strange reactions of the citizens of totalitarianism and their culture as a whole, on the one hand, and the reactions of the sick schizophrenic on the other." The social transformation that unfolds under totalitarianism is built upon and sustained by delusions. For only deluded men and women regress to the childlike status of obedient and submissive subjects and hand over complete control of their lives to politicians and bureaucrats. Only a deluded ruling class will believe that they possess the knowledge, wisdom, and acumen to completely control society in a top-down manner. And only when under the spell of delusions would anyone believe that a society composed of power-hungry rulers, on the one hand, and a psychologically regressed population, on the other, will lead to anything other than mass suffering and social ruin. But what triggers the psychosis of totalitarianism? As was explored in the previous video of this series, the mass psychosis of totalitarianism begins in a society's ruling class. The individuals that make up this class, be it politicians, bureaucrats, or crony capitalists, are very prone to delusions that augment their power, and no delusion is more attractive to the power-hungry than the delusion that they can and should control and dominate a society. When a ruling elite becomes possessed by a political ideology of this sort, be it communism, fascism, or technocracy, the next step is to induce a population into accepting their rule by infecting them with the mass psychosis of totalitarianism. This psychosis has been induced many times throughout history, and as Mirlu explains, it is simply a question of reorganizing and manipulating collective feelings in the proper way. The general method by which the members of a ruling elite can accomplish this end is called menticide, with the etymology of this word being a killing of the mind, and as Mirlu further explains, menticide is an old crime against the human mind and spirit, but systematized anew. It is an organized system of psychological intervention and judicial perversion through which a ruling class can imprint their own opportunistic thoughts upon the minds of those they plan to use and destroy. Priming a population for the crime of menticide begins with the sowing of fear. When an individual is flooded with negative emotions, such as fear or anxiety, he or she is very susceptible to a descent into the delusions of madness. Threats, real, imagined, or fabricated, can be used to sow fear, but a particularly effective technique is to use waves of terror. Under this technique, the sowing of fear is staggered with periods of calm. But each of these periods of calm is followed by the manufacturing of an even more intense spell of fear. And on, the process goes. Or as Mirlu writes, each wave of terrorizing creates its effects more easily after a breathing spell than the one that preceded it, because people are still disturbed by their previous experience. Morality becomes lower and lower, and the psychological effects of each new propaganda campaign become stronger. It reaches a public already softened up. While fear primes a population for menticide, the use of propaganda to spread misinformation and to promote confusion with respect to the source of the threats and the nature of the crisis helps to break down the minds of the masses. Government officials and their lackeys in the media can use contradictory reports, nonsensical information, and even blatant lies, as the more they confuse, the less capable will a population be to cope with the crisis and diminish their fear in a rational and adaptive manner. Confusion, in other words, heightens the susceptibility of a descent into the delusions of totalitarianism. Or as Mirlu explains, logic can be met with logic, while illogic cannot. It confuses those who think straight. The big lie and monotonously repeated nonsense have more emotional appeal than logic and reason. While the people are still searching for a reasonable counterargument to the first lie, the totalitarians can assault them with another. Never before in history have such effective means existed to manipulate a society into the psychosis of totalitarianism. Smartphones and social media, television and the internet, all in conjunction with algorithms that quickly censor the flow of unwanted information, allow those in power to easily assault the minds of the masses. What is more, the addictive nature of these technologies means that many people voluntarily subject themselves to the ruling elite's propaganda with a remarkable frequency. Modern technology, explains Mirlu, teaches man to take for granted the world he is looking at. He takes no time to retreat and reflect. Technology lures him on, dropping him into its wheels and movements. No rest, no meditation, no reflection, no conversation. The senses are continually overloaded with stimuli. Man doesn't learn to question his world anymore. The screen offers him answers, ready-made. But there is a further step the would-be totalitarian rulers can take to increase the chance of a totalitarian psychosis, and this is to isolate the victims and to disrupt normal social interactions. When alone and lacking normal interactions with friends, family, and co-workers, an individual becomes far more susceptible to delusions for several reasons. Firstly, they lose contact with the corrective force of the positive example, for not everyone is tricked by the machinations of the ruling elite, and the individuals who see through the propaganda can help free others from the menticidal assault. If, however, isolation is enforced, the power of these positive examples greatly diminishes. But another reason that isolation increases the efficacy of menticide is because, like many other species, human beings are more easily conditioned into new patterns of thought and behavior when isolated. Or as Mirlu explains with regards to the physiologist Ivan Pavlov's work on behavioral conditioning, Pavlov made another significant discovery. The conditioned reflex could be developed most easily in a quiet laboratory with a minimum of disturbing stimuli. Every trainer of animals knows this from his own experience. Isolation and the patient repetition of stimuli are required to tame wild animals. The totalitarians have followed this rule. They know that they can condition their political victims most quickly if they are kept in isolation. Alone, confused, and battered by waves of terror, a population under an attack of menticide descends into a hopeless and vulnerable state. The never-ending stream of propaganda turns minds once capable of rational thought into playhouses of irrational forces. And with chaos swirling around them and within them, the masses crave a return to a more ordered world. The would-be totalitarians can now take the decisive step. They can offer a way out and a return to order in a world that seems to be moving rapidly in the opposite direction. But all this comes at a price. The masses must give up their freedom and cede control of all aspects of life to the ruling elite. They must relinquish their capacity to be self-reliant individuals who are responsible for their own lives and become submissive and obedient subjects. The masses, in other words, must descend into the delusions of the totalitarian psychosis. The totalitarian systems of the 20th century represent a kind of collective psychosis. Whether gradually or suddenly, reason and common human decency are no longer possible in such a system. There is only a pervasive atmosphere of terror and a projection of the enemy, imagined to be in our midst. Thus society turns on itself, urged on by the ruling authorities. But the order of a totalitarian world is a pathological order. By enforcing a strict conformity and requiring a blind obedience from the citizenry, totalitarianism rids the world of the spontaneity that produces many of life's joys and the creativity that drives society forward. The total control of this form of rule, no matter under what name it is branded, be it rule by scientists and doctors, politicians and bureaucrats, or a dictator, breeds stagnation, destruction, and death on a mass scale. And so perhaps the most important question facing the world is how can totalitarianism be prevented? And if a society has been induced into the early stages of this mass psychosis, can the effects be reversed? While one can never be sure of the prognosis of a collective madness, there are steps that can be taken to help effectuate a cure. This task, however, necessitates many different approaches from many different people. For just as the menticidal attack is multi-pronged, so too must be the counterattack. According to Carl Jung, for those of us who wish to help return sanity to an insane world, the first step is to bring order to our own minds and to live in a way that provides inspiration for others to follow. It is not for nothing that our age cries out for the Redeemer personality, for the one who can emancipate himself from the grip of the collective psychosis and save at least his own soul, who lights a beacon of hope for others, proclaiming that here is at least one man who has succeeded in extricating himself from the fatal identity with the group psyche. But assuming one is living in a manner free of the grip of the psychosis, there are further steps that can be taken. Information that counters the propaganda should be spread as far and as wide as possible, for the truth is more powerful than the fiction and falsities peddled by the would-be totalitarian rulers, and so their success is in part contingent on their ability to censor the free flow of information. Another tactic is to use humor and ridicule to delegitimize the ruling elite, or as Mirlu explains, we must learn to treat the demagogue and aspirant dictators in our midst with the weapon of ridicule. The demagogue himself is almost incapable of humor of any sort, and if we treat him with humor, he will begin to collapse. A tactic recommended by Vaclav Havel, a political dissident under Soviet communist rule, who later became president of Czechoslovakia, is the construction of what are called parallel structures. A parallel structure is any form of organization, business, institution, technology, or creative pursuit that exists physically within a totalitarian society, yet morally outside of it. In communist Czechoslovakia, Havel noted that these parallel structures were more effective at combating totalitarianism than political action. Furthermore, when enough parallel structures are created, a second culture, or parallel society, spontaneously forms and functions as an enclave of freedom and sanity within a totalitarian world. Or as Havel explains in his book, The Power of the Powerless. What else are parallel structures than an area where a different life can be lived? A life that is in harmony with its own aims, and which in turn structures itself in harmony with those aims. What else are those initial attempts at social self-organization than the efforts of a certain part of society to rid itself of the self-sustaining aspects of totalitarianism, and thus, to extricate itself radically from its involvement in the totalitarian system? But above all else, what is required to prevent a full descent into the madness of totalitarianism is action by as many people as possible. For just as the ruling elite do not sit around passively, but instead take deliberate steps to increase their power, so too, an active and concerted effort must be made to move the world back in the direction of freedom. This can be an immense challenge in a world falling prey to the delusions of totalitarianism, but as Thomas Paine noted, tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. For more content like this, visit the YouTube channel Academy of Ideas or the website academyofideas.com.
An interesting video on that Academy of Ideas YouTube channel is called The Parallel Society versus Totalitarianism, How to Create a Free World. That's only 12 minutes long. I think I might showcase that at some point in the future. Next, again from the After School YouTube channel, is Chemical Farming and the Loss of Human Health with Dr. Zach Bush.
We've literally built an entire economy of not just the United States, but the entire Western civilization on healthcare. And that's been a hidden reality for a long time. Mm-hmm. But for thousands of years, the real control of populations has been around their food. And we find ourselves in that same, you know, if not amped up version now that we have 7 billion souls on the planet. That becomes very, very big business when you start to be able to control food. And we see that the ultimate political control is around the food chain and whether it delivers health or not. I've basically found myself in a massively reductionist state of my understanding of the world around us when I had really spent, you know, 20 years of my life studying medicine, which was the opposite, where every year and minute you study in that environment, they try to convince you it's more and more complicated, that there's 1,000 different diseases, that there's 10,000 different drugs to treat those diseases. But in reality, what started to deconstruct that world was the realization that the cancer I was studying under the microscope when I was devising chemotherapy happened to be really the exact same process as an ulcer in the ankle of a diabetic patient. Again, sound totally disparate, but in the end, totally reductionist viewpoint is it's only one thing, which is chronic inflammation. Inflammation is actually a normal biologic response to an injury. If we have a chronic inflammatory epidemic in the world, which is a better definition than lots of diseases, then we must be overwhelming the immune system of all of the public for some reason at the same time. Sometime between 1982 and 2000, we had did something to the environment to totally decimate the protection system of our immune systems. And the big tip-off to me in this process, you know, here I am in the labs developing chemotherapy and is so buried down the rabbit hole of the pharmaceutical model. But there was a big tip-off starting to happen in the late 1990s and early 2000s that we were seeing diseases in what seemed like completely different organ systems in the population go epidemic simultaneously. Examples of this was certainly autism that you mentioned earlier. We had 1 in 5,000 children with autism in 1975. Today, we have just 3 weeks ago released the most recent data, 1 in 36 children with an autism spectrum disorder. And the big argument for a long time was, well, maybe we're just diagnosing and recognizing autism better, which is kind of laughable if you've ever sat with an autistic child. Here's a five-year-old who can't speak, can't make eye contact, hits his head on the wall for a few hours a day to try to console his terror. We didn't miss that in 1975. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not a diagnostic dilemma. But then to further emphasize that, the fastest acceleration in that growth pattern of this epidemic has happened between 2012 and today, where we're seeing a doubling time every 2 to 3 years in that autism rate. At the current rate, we'll see 1 in 3 children with autism in 2035. And then in 1996, we saw this sudden rise in the Alzheimer's dementia in women. Interestingly, the Alzheimer's rates has not changed in males since that time. But at the same time, 1996, we see this uptick and consistent linear growth parallel to that Alzheimer's track in women with Parkinson's in males. And so we have, you know, species-specific, gender-specific, organ-specific diseases in the brain and peripheral cancers, all of which took off at the same time in the mid-1990s. Autoimmune disease. Unbelievable epidemic starting in the late 1990s. And so this was like the cracks that were starting to form in my worldview that maybe there weren't 1,000 different diseases because they all started going epidemic at once, which really begged the question, is there a root cause of the root cause of the root cause of all disease? In the same way that we've misunderstood the gut and what gut health means, we misunderstood soil for the longest time. And in the early 1900s, really the late 1880s, we started to change the way we farmed. Simple things happened, like we went to steel grinding for wheat instead of stone grinding it, which meant we could get more of the fiber out of it, which we created a higher gluten and a higher refined carbohydrate load in our flours and in our wheat system and everything else. So that's one example of a shift. But the main thing that happened is we started to disrespect the importance of crop rotation and soil rest, cover cropping, etc. This led to a massive death of the topsoil, which led to the Dust Bowl that ran through the 1920s and 30s. And it's fascinating that here we are only 80 years out from this event where our ancestors, you know, two generations, three generations, were literally starving to death. We had soup lines that went for days, you know, across the entire Midwest, and houses were literally being buried in dust of dead soil that had died. During the Dust Bowl, we actually, for the first time, started to outsource our food production because these people lost their local gardens and farms. Mm-hmm. So we started to rely on importing food for the first time, and we started to outsource that concept. Then World War II hit, and we did something interesting, which is we had this huge petroleum industry that was revved up bigger than it had ever been in the history because we had all tanks, jeeps, mechanized warfare for the first time in human history on this scale. We had planes for the first time. I mean, this was like full out, totally different thing that had ever happened in history, and it was a world war, much different than World War One in its scope. And so we see this huge petroleum industry that suddenly grinds to a halt because the war is over. So we have this glut of petroleum, and we suddenly realize we can extract nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium out of that that oil, and we started making chemical-based fertilizers for the first time. So they found a new marketplace for this oil, and it was a great message to the farmers who were still suffering with bad dirt in the Midwest. Is like, you don't need to do crop rotation. You don't need to compost. You don't need to go back to thousands of years of farming tradition. Just spray this chemical on there.
Yeah, forget about whatever you might have learned during the Dust Bowl.
Yeah. You know? That was 40 years ago. That's all ancient times. We're modern now.
Yeah.
And so these farmers started using it, and it became a revolution for them, and it was actually called the Green Revolution of the 1960s. And so the Green Revolution was actually use of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, or NPK fertilizers. And the NPK fertilizer did turn plants green because nitrogen and phosphorus do that. But what was lacking in those plants for the first time in history was the nutrients and the medicine that should always have been in that food. And so the plants became weak. Just like a human being who lacks nutrients, their immune system goes down. And when a plant's immune system goes down, it becomes prone to viruses, pests, and it can't excrete the stuff from the root system that would keep weeds at bay. And so now the plants are getting, you know, attacked from the outside, if you will, and the chemical industry says, no problem, here's a new chemical weed killer, here's a pesticide. And so the farmers got themselves locked into this codependent relationship with chemical fertilizers, then chemical drugs for the plants to keep them alive despite a failing biology underneath the surface there.
Right. Akin to taking a drug to deal with the symptoms of some ailment that you have that creates a whole battery of side effects that then require you to take another drug to deal with those. It's just an environmental version of that.
It's exactly the same thing. And in fact, the drugs have been the same in a lot of ways. The main drug is antibiotics. Western medicine really got its first foothold with penicillin, our first antibiotic, and that happened to be in the 1940s with World War II. And so we developed in the same decade the antibiotics that would kill the bacteria in our body with the antibiotics that would kill the soil. Mm-hmm. And I say antibiotic because these chemicals that we were using as pesticides are largely antibiotic rather than, you know, what you would think of maybe a weed killer or something. And the most famous of these, of course, has become Roundup, the most single successful chemical warfare that's ever been sold on the planet. We currently sell and use 4.5 billion pounds of glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in the chemical, to treat the soils of the earth. 4.5 billion pounds of a single chemical annually. That chemical was never patented as a weed killer. It's only been patented as an antibiotic, and then it was repatented as an antiparasite, antifungal.
Yeah, that was the original purpose of it, correct?
Well, it's the mechanism. It's the mechanism they recognized. And so the mechanism of glyphosate is to go in and block enzymes in soil bacteria, fungi, and plants. And that enzyme pathway is called the shikimate pathway, and it's important because it makes a number of the essential amino acids. Our bodies are composed of over 200,000 proteins, but we only have 20,000 genes. We have this pathetically dumb genome in the sense that a flea has 30,000 genes. So you're two-thirds as complicated as a flea at the gene level, which I find reassuring. If I can't find my keys or I'm having a bad day, I'm like, hey, I'm two-thirds as complicated as a flea. What are my real expectations here? But the reality is we're very simple at the genetic level. And yet we make over 200,000 proteins from a bunch of amino acids. There's 26 amino acids that will build those 200,000 proteins. Those 26 amino acids are just like the 26 letters of the English alphabet in the sense that the vast majority of those are useful but not critical. But the vowels, these eight vowels in our language, if you subtract one of those vowels, you can affect hundreds of thousands of words. The vowels in the amino acid vocabulary here are the essential amino acids, which if you start to tweak any of those nine, you're going to start to lose tens of thousands of protein structures in their functionality and in their unique form. And so those essential amino acids, not only are they important like the vowels, they also can't be made by the human body. So those nine have to come from your food chain somewhere. And it turns out that they are only made by the bacteria, the fungi, and the plants. You don't have a shikimate pathway in your human cells. And so these essential amino acids are blocked through the shikimate pathway by Roundup. And so imagine treating a food chain with a chemical that blocks the ability of these plants to make the building blocks for a healthy human body. Mm-hmm. Forget about a human. It's a dog, a cat, any mammal, any complex multicellular biology is going to depend on these essential amino acids. And we literally, in the last 15 years, subtracted out the ability to build the body because we changed the 26 letters. And so the current statistics is that less than 0.1% of the Roundup used on the planet actually hits a weed. The other 99.99% gets into the soil and into the water system and washes off. And so we are now seeing the runoff from these farms and in the water table itself. So we have fossil aquifers in the United States here that run from Canada all the way down to, historically, Mexico, that has now dried up. We've turned over 1,000 square miles of Texas into desert over just the last 20 years from sucking water out of the ground. Mm-hmm. That fossil aquifer is now contaminated with Roundup that's filtered down into this ancient freshwater source for us. And then in the same moment, you've got the Mississippi River, which collects over 80% of all of the Roundup in the country. And then it's evaporating the whole time, so it's going into the air that you breathe, and then it goes into the clouds, and then it rains down on us. Recent studies in the air and rainfall in the southern United States is showing 75% of the rain, 75% of the air contaminated with Roundup. So before you even take a bite of food, insane. You're being hit with an antibiotic when you breathe. You're getting hit with an antibiotic when you experience rainfall. And so you may be growing organic crops, but they're getting rained on. And so we have now locked this water-soluble toxin into our environment. Fortunately, you know, to give you a little bit of breather here from the bad news, is that there are bacteria and fungi that can eventually digest the glyphosate. The downside is we need to stop spraying it so that they can return. Mm-hmm. We're decimating those very bacteria and fungi by the presence of Roundup to the point where they're not digesting it. Current estimates is if we stop spraying Roundup tomorrow, it would take about 50 years before our ecosystem saw a drop in the level of Roundup below our toxic level. If the conspiracy theorist was right, then we'd see 1 in 2 people with cancer, we'd see 1 in 30 kids with autism, we'd see Parkinson's going crazy. You know, they're literally repeating back, if it was toxic, we would see literally what we're seeing, you know. And so the reality is the public health statistics have gotten so grim in the last 8 years that nobody can call this a conspiracy theory anymore.
Right, but it's almost like, yeah, but that's, where's the direct, where's the smoking gun?
The smoking gun is what's been missing. Mm-hmm. That's what we found in 2012. So in 2012, we found it backwards. I don't think anybody's actually smart enough with the human gray matter that we're given to actually create a paradigm shift prospectively, right? So every great, you know, mind that we look to in past, Galileo or, you know, Ben Franklin or anybody, we said, oh, they discovered something, or, you know, Edison. These just came at moments when the evidence got so overwhelming that it became obvious, right? And so in the same way, in 2012, the evidence was getting so overwhelming that we were onto something in the nutrition world. But we, at the time, I was still thinking cancer therapy, because my background was in chemotherapy development. And so when I found these molecules in soil that looked similar to the chemotherapy I'd been making, a lot of bells started ringing of like, what is that? Where did it come from? How is there medicine in the dirt? Like, where is that coming from? And within a few weeks of that discovery of those molecules, we found out that bacteria and fungi were making these specific shapes of these carbon molecules. And that really closed the loop for me, because there had been some papers coming out in the mid-2000s in the cancer world that were starting to say that the bacteria in your gut were predicting which cancers you would get. If you're missing these bacteria, you would get prostate cancer. If you had these bacteria, you would get breast cancer. That was so radically bizarre and out there for our current model, even to this day, as to how cancer worked. But now you fast forward 8-10 years, and now there's tens of thousands of articles that are showing that genomically, mm-hmm. the bacterial genome is way more mm-hmm. important in determining cancer than the human genome. And so this reality was hitting. And so in 2012, when we discovered these chemicals that look a little like chemotherapy that are made by bacteria and fungi in the soil, it suddenly closed the loop of, oh my gosh, what if the bacteria in our gut is doing the same thing? What if the bacteria and the fungi are actually our best source of medicine mm-hmm. for everything? Mm-hmm. And so that's the direction we were going. But as soon as we put this into petri dishes with cancer cells and beyond, we suddenly realized, no, there's something way deeper happening with this information stream coming out of bacteria and fungi. And it was my chief science officer, Dr. John Gilday, he's a PhD in genetics and cell biology, and he was the first to realize that we had put our finger on the glyphosate toxicity issue, is that this communication network from the bacteria and fungi was actually supporting the protein structure in our gut lining. And so it turns out that the gut is held together, these trillions of cells that make up that cellophane layer, by tight junctions. Mm-hmm. These are Velcro-like proteins that hold one microscopic cell to the next to create this coherent carpet. And he had recognized before this, in a number of other labs had started to publish, that glyphosate seemed to increase the permeability of this membrane. And nobody was really sure why yet. But we suddenly realized that if this bacterial communication network was in there, we couldn't injure the membrane. It became bulletproof to the glyphosate injury. And so in that journey, we started to really study glyphosate and its relationship to the human cells, because like you said, Monsanto's been swearing up and down that there is no harm to the human body because the shikimate pathway only exists in bacteria and fungi. Well, that may be true regarding that enzyme target, but the classic thing with any drug is it always has off-target effects, mm-hmm. right? So that's why drugs have side effects, is they don't actually go and do exactly what your doctor says it's going to go do. It's going to hit a bunch of other receptors and do other things. The side effects of glyphosate that are outside of the shikimate pathway is direct injury to the protein structure that holds your gut lining together. This would be bad news if that was it, but it turns out that every macromembrane in your body, the blood vessels that fuel your entire body with oxygen and nutrients, are held together with the same tight junctions. The blood-brain barrier that protects your peripheral nervous system and your brain, same tight junctions. The kidney tubules that are held together to detox your body, same tight junctions. And so what's happened as we've introduced a chemical that's directly toxic to this Velcro-like protein is we turn into leaky sieves on the front end, gut leak and nasal sinus leak. And so every time we breathe, every time we eat, we're starting to leak and our immune system gets overwhelmed. And then the blood vessels that are supposed to deliver either an immune response from peripheral or get nutrients to some distant space is also leaking. And so we're getting permeability of the blood mm-hmm. vessels. Then you get to the blood-brain barrier. This is supposed to be the holy of holies. A peripheral nerve or the brain is supposed to be protected against everything in your blood, because even glucose, which is the main fuel for your brain, should not get into the brain in an unregulated fashion. It will damage the nerves. And so the holy of holies of the central and peripheral nervous system is being destroyed. And so if that's true, if glyphosate was really damaging that, then we should see a massive explosion in neurologic injury to children and adults starting in about 1996. That's exactly when we see this steep increase happening in autism, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, neurodegenerative conditions like MS, autoimmune diseases, and all the rest. I mean, all of this has sounded like a lot of bad news, but identifying a problem is so much of the solution. Mm-hmm. You know, and so now that we identify the problem, look, we've put into our food chain a chemical that deletes the ability to build a healthy human body. We've put into the food chain a chemical that deletes the medicine out of our food, which we didn't have time to talk about, but that same shikimate pathway makes the alkaloids, which are the medicinal features of our food, is deleted by glyphosate. So we can build a diseased body, we build a food chain that doesn't have the medicine in it, and then we take away the most, you know, vital thing, which is this microcosm, macrocosm phenomenon you just talked about. So far, I've been describing to you that we are losing the identity between the outside world and our immune system by the breakdown of these membranes. We get leak. That's literally taking away self-identity from the immune system, and so we get autoimmune disease where we're starting to react to our own body as if it was foreign. In the same way, at the macro level, I believe we're losing our self-identity as human beings as we start to leak. And we start to become majorly depressed, panic disorder. We start to get lost down these rabbit holes of doubt, insecurity, fear, guilt. We have spiritual crisis. We have relationship crisis that's on an epidemic level equal to cancer and beyond. The ability to stay in human relationship seems to be the most complicated thing that we could possibly endure right now. It's because we are literally losing self-identity at the cell level, because we are eating a chemical that breaks our self-identity at the cell level. As sickness happens, and it results in an immune reaction and a healing process. I think that's what's happening to our society right now. We have a sickness and a disease on the planet of loss of self-identity and human consciousness of our purpose here, only to trigger the ultimate healing process, mm-hmm. which is to realize that we're all one. We are all on one mission to find truth in ourselves and through one another. We are calling in community. We are going to overcome the isolation of our cell phone era. We're going to start to touch each other more. We're going to hug each other more because we have to. And that's a beautiful healing process that I already see afoot in the world around me. And I'm blessed to be able to go and speak all over the world right now. And I'm blessed in that journey to see humans changing their macro consciousness as they change their diet, as they change their nutrition, as they get in touch with their food chain, as they put bacterial and fungal communication networks back into their body. They come back 18 months later to my clinic and they'll say, "Doc, I just left my husband. He's been abusing me for 35 years and I finally realized I don't deserve that." Mm-hmm. And I left. And so a woman can in an instant suddenly realize, as her boundaries go up at the gut and at the blood-brain barrier, her macro boundaries of that's not spiritually and psychologically appropriate. I am me. I am important. I am loved. I don't need that kind of abuse in my life. In the same way, I'll have somebody walk in and say, Doc, I just quit my job. I just started my company that I've been wanting to start for 30 years and wasn't confident enough to start. And I just realized I am ready and I just did it. And so I have this goosebump experience over and over again, despite some of the, you know, tragedy that's in the talks that I give and the science that I now know. And I'm constantly seeing this bubbling up of human hope and human healing and consciousness coming on. And I take great hope in that. I take great excitement that if a few of us can become conscious and aware and awake right now, it has a ripple effect that is so quick, and it has to be quick, because one thing we can be certain with, no matter what background we come from scientifically or politically, we can agree that any society faced with 1 in 3 children with autism will collapse under a financial blow that is inescapable. And so we're about 16 years away from a sure, complete collapse of our financial status as a country, and yet we don't hear a single politician talking about it. Because why? Because the politicians are not the solution. You and I are the solution as consumers, and we are doing it already. The organic food movement, nobody predicted how successful it was going to be. 10 years ago, it was less than 1% of the food sold in the country, and now we're pushing it. You know, we're up to maybe 4 or 5% in a lot of communities. If we can push that to 16%, these are numbers that were apparently leaked from Monsanto. In their marketing analysis, if the American food chain became 16% organic, Monsanto and chemical farming would lose its financial stability.
Thank you for watching this episode of After School. I'm Dr. Zach Bush, and I'm just honored to be with the community. At the fabric of our nature is the message and capacity for regeneration. And fascinatingly, after the last 5 extinction events on the planet, there has been an explosion of life. Because in fact, the fabric of the genome, the fabric of biology as it is made, is that of adaptation and diversification. After every major extinction event, the level of stress within the genome inspires more creativity. It is not a demise, it is not a victim, it sees the opportunity for something more dynamic, more adaptive, and more resilient, and ultimately more intelligent. After that last great extinction, the world did not suffer back or struggle back to create the dinosaurs. Instead, Mother Nature envisioned the possibility of birds, mammals, humans. And here we walk the earth today. And we have triggered an extinction event through our extraction and our consumption because of our belief that we are separate from nature, that we need to control her, that we need to domineer her, and that we actually are some sort of manifest destiny towards her consumption. Changing that mindset and coming into alignment with Mother Nature will create a future that none of us can imagine. We could in fact be a part of that new adaptation of biology on Earth for a more intelligent, more diverse, and more explosively regenerative future. I look forward to being there with you.
This video has been The Chemical Farming and the Loss of Human Health by Dr. Zach Bush from the YouTube channel After School, spelled after S-K-O-O-L. We'll finish the hour with the great Ram Dass and his The Freedom of Being Nobody. Ram Dass, famous philosopher, psychologist, psychedelic pioneer, spelled R-A-M-D-A-S-S. And now, The Freedom of Being Nobody.
To the extent that I am anything at all, we could consider me as a separate entity, a set of predisposing characteristics, a program that is manifesting by taking a human birth at this time. I have taken a birth into a body. And that body has with it a personality. I've taken a birth into a personality, and that personality is in a body. And I am going through a set of experiences which is called living life. And these experiences have a certain function. These experiences, if used consciously and intentionally by me, are vehicles through which I can awaken to who I am in truth. Let me take you through an example I often use, just another little metaphorical image and an analogy. Imagine, for example, that you have next to your eyes a little control switch, and you look at another human being on channel one. And what you see when you look at the other human being is a physical body. Man, woman, old, young, fat, thin, pretty, handsome, ugly, interesting. If you're a scientist, you might call them mesomorphs, ectomorphs, and endomorphs. Okay? It's a matrix of individual differences on physical plane. It's the plane of standing on the corner watching all the girls go by. It's that reality. Now let's just say you're looking at another person and you flick your television receiver one channel. Now you look at another person and what you see is their psychology. Oh, you're a manic depressive. Oh, you're a happy person. I wish I was happy like you. People in psychotherapy live on this channel usually. They're totally preoccupied with their own depressions, elations, fears, anxieties, loneliness, hopes, etc. And that's reality. That's the real you. And the physical body is merely the carrier of that. Well, let's flip it again. Flip it again and you look at another person, and if you are so trained to be able to see on this channel, you would say, oh, I know who you are. You're a Libra. I can tell because of the blah. You're a Sagittarius. On this channel, on channel three, there's only 12 beings in the universe and various permutations of them. Okay. You are now seeing what could be known as the astral identity of an individual. You're seeing another plane of reality. You're seeing another way of looking at individual differences. These are three ways of looking at individual differences, three matrices, if you will. But now you flip the dial once more. It starts to get interesting. Now if you flip the dial and look into another person's eyes, you flip the dial inside your own being and look into another person's eyes, what you see is another being looking back at you inside an astral configuration, a personality, and a body. You in there? I'm in here. How did you get into that one? And you see what the Christians call soul. You see another soul. You see another being just like you. No different, just like you, just another being. And that you see that all the individual differences are all of the stuff in which this being is encased. Now, you could almost be comfortable with that one, but we unfortunately must flick the dial a few more times. I mean, I must take you the whole journey. You flick the next dial, and what you see when you look into someone else's eyes is you see yourself looking at yourself, looking at yourself. Because on that plane, there is only one of it. It is one awareness that is in a multiplicity of forms. And finally, if you will allow me to flick the dial just once more, if you haven't given up completely yet, you flip the dial once more, and you disappear, and I disappear, and the dial disappears. And we're dealing with what the Buddhists call void. Or in the New Testament, before the word. That is, before the vibratory uniqueness. Or why God is not able to be spelled in the Hebrew religion. It's unspeakable, unknowable, unseeable, unconceivable, inconceivable. Okay, now of all of these channels on the television set, who are you? Which one do you want to settle for? You want to be middle-aged? How about that one? I mean, I'm middle-aged. I guess I'm middle-aged. I have a 47-year-old body. It's like I have also a 1974 Dodge van. But you say to me, who are you? And I don't say I'm a Dodge van. Why do I choose to identify with this? Well, if I don't pick body, should I pick personality? I'm somebody on the path. That's a good one to be. I'm a curious person. I'm curious about the future. That's a good one. I'm a responsible person. Well, I'm kind of wild. I'm lazy. I'm working on myself. These are all different psychological takes of who one is. Each plane, each turn of the dial has a different statement of your identity, and each one is getting into a more and more profound place. Now when we come back to who am I, which channel are you talking about? If we start from the top and go on down into the grosser planes, I am the void who manifests as the one, who becomes the many, who has a unique set of factors to work out through a unique astral, psychological, and physical body. That's what I'm doing on Earth. I have taken a body to do certain work. And when I finish that work, I will drop that body. We are dealing here with the issues of karma and reincarnation. Now, in the West, after the councils of Trent, Constantinople, and Nicaea, anywhere from about 200 to 500 AD, these ideas were roughly thrown out of Christianity because they didn't make the church a workable situation. Because when you had reincarnation and karma, every human being became their own priest. Because it was between you and God. And for the church to keep its own control and see its function as keeping people morally living properly, it had to get rid of those concepts. Have I taken birth before? I have no experiential knowledge of that. But from where I'm sitting, undoubtedly thousands and thousands and thousands of times. Will I take birth again? Undoubtedly thousands and thousands and thousands of times. I have to tax your brain with one more difficult concept. As long as we were dealing with your body, with your personality, with your astral identity, or with your soul, we were dealing in time. Time passes, things change. The minute we got up into the higher plane than that, in the one, there is no time anymore. Time is relative. Now we're dealing with the place where when you know yourself as that, you just are. You are going nowhere and you are coming from nowhere. The Zen master says your going and coming is nowhere but where you are. Now, if you can start to sense, I mean, you don't have to believe what I'm saying just because it's the way the universe looks to me, but if you could empathize just enough to appreciate how it would be to be looking at the world from this point of view, if you imagine what it's like to see your life as so functional to your awakening and your death equally so, that the whole business becomes merely a process of growth and awakening and opening and deepening and clearing and shifting channels. And there is no problem about transition. There's no holding on out of fear. It's just opening.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. My show runs 6 to 8 p.m. every Friday. I will see you next time with more information.
Due to COVID-19, WMFO DJs are pre-recording their shows for broadcast on air. We can still accept phone calls, but the phone line is in voicemail mode. Call 855-915-9636 and be sure to leave the DJ's name in the voicemail so we can forward it to the correct person. The following program was recorded earlier. Enjoy.